Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. The court has three matters on its oral submission calendar this morning. In the order in which they will be submitted, they are 00-0292 Subaru of America Incorporated against David McDavid Nissen Incorporated from Dallas County, 00-0513 Bootnaru versus Ford Motor Company from Valverde County, and 00-0548 In re First Merit Bank, an original mandamus proceeding. The court will take a brief recess in between the arguments in these cases and will conclude the submissions prior to lunch. An oral recording is being made of the arguments, and counsel may inquire at the clerk's office about obtaining a copy of the tape. The Chief Justice is in hearings in the legislature and will participate in the decisions of all of these cases. The court is ready to hear argument in 292 Subaru against David McDavid Nissen.
May it please the court, Mr. Bruce C. Morris will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. This is an original jurisdiction case, not an exclusive remedies case. More specifically, factually, this case involves a dealer relocation. As the opinion currently stands, either a dealer or a manufacturer can in-run the board's jurisdiction in the core relocation issue by merely filing a district court action that omits the express statutory violations under Section 5.02. This raises three issues this morning. First, did the board have original jurisdiction, either express or implied, over the claims made by Mr. McDavid? Secondly, did the primary jurisdiction require adjudication of the board claims first? And thirdly, is Section 3.01B of the code unconstitutional? With regards to the first issue, petitioner submits that the court had original exclusive, that the board had original exclusive jurisdiction to regulate the particular
claim. I'm a little bit confused about what your second question is then. If your first question goes to, are you saying that there's exclusive jurisdiction or primary jurisdiction?
I'm saying that in this particular case that the board had exclusive jurisdiction. Alternatively, if this court holds that there was not exclusive jurisdiction.
But your briefing, all your points just talk about primary jurisdiction. I mean, yes, primary jurisdiction.
Your Honor, my briefing may not have been clear, but
that's why we're asking the question. So you're now arguing that, in fact, you think there is exclusive jurisdiction in the board for everything.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you do recognize the difference between the two doctrines.
Yes, sir.
Well, I think that's important in this case. So tell us why you think it is exclusive there.
I believe if you read Sections 3.01A and 3.01B, Section 3.01A specifically says the board has original power and jurisdiction to regulate all aspects of the sale and distribution, including whether specifically designated or implied. That includes the original jurisdiction to determine its own jurisdiction.
Original but not exclusive.
The statute does not say exclusive in 3.01A, correct?
But it does in B.
Yes, Your Honor.
You think that's a significant omission in A? It seems to be your argument that original means exclusive too?
I believe that Section 3.01A and 3.01B should be read together. If you look at the statute, the subsection specifically is jurisdiction. And so petitioner submits that you have to read those provisions specifically together. With regards to the claims before in this case, they're very limited. They go to the absolute core issue of relocation. With regards to the specific claims that are currently on appeal, there was a good faith and fair duty, a claim for good faith and fair duty. Second one, breach of an oral agreement, as well as those are the two main ones. With regards to the duty of good faith claim, that is specifically created by statute under Section 6.06E. And the code expressly requires that under Section 6.06A, that it states, in any action brought under this section, which is Section 6.06, that if there's a judgment, that any court shall pay due deference to the findings. Thus, with regards to the case of duty of good faith and fair dealing, that provision expressly requires findings by the commission. Thus, logic dictates that in order for a court to review the findings, it must have gone to the commission first.
Well, the argument's made by the other side that there's a difference between what 606E and the section that talks about the DTPA claim and findings based on violations before you can file a DTPA, but that language is not in E. And it also says that the good faith and fair dealing gives rise to a tort claim in the trial court.
Yes.
Doesn't that make a significant difference between these two?
Well, Your Honor, with regards to the duty of good faith and fair dealing, it is our position that the fact that it talks about the tort, that's the duty in court, goes to remedies. It does not go to original jurisdiction.
Well, but also, the commission cannot award damages for breach of the good faith and fair dealing when it's brought as a DTPA action, can it?
In this particular case, Your Honor, the commission was not even given the opportunity to decide that issue.
Well, if it doesn't have the power under the statute, how can it decide one way or the other that it has when it's limited to civil penalties, injunctive relief, and some third thing that doesn't include awarding common law damages or damages under the DTPA?
Under the statute, the Section 6.06 does not specifically say, does not specifically give the commission power to...
But the other part that does tell them what they can do by way of remedy is pretty specific, isn't it?
Yes, under 6.06A. But I believe 6.06A, the first part of it, talks specifically about the DTPA and the remedies available to it. But it also specifically says, and I'm quoting, in any action brought under this section, being Section 6.06, which in this particular case would include the breach of good faith and fair dealing as to franchise agreements. And in the interest of judicial economy, a judgment rendered shall pay due deference to the findings of fact and conclusions of law.
But Mr. Morris, by referencing all of these particular provisions, aren't you in fact then acknowledging that there is not exclusive jurisdiction?
On our particular
yes.
claims? Your Honor, we believe that if, with regard to the breach of good faith and fair dealing, that is expressly.
Well, but let me. I mean, your first position is that the board has exclusive jurisdiction. What test for exclusive jurisdiction are you asking us to apply in this case?
I'm limiting this to the particular facts in this case. And before
it seems to me it's a question of law whether or not the legislature has in fact given the board exclusive jurisdiction. Either it has or it hasn't.
I agree, Your Honor.
Okay, so what test are you applying then to make a determination of that exclusive jurisdiction lies with the board?
It is our position that with regards to the duty of good faith and fair dealing claim, that the code, if you look at the express language of the code, it gives the commission original jurisdiction.
Well, but I'm talking, This court's jurisprudence on the question of exclusive jurisdiction requires us to determine whether or not the statute reveals the legislature's intent to replace the plaintiff's common law remedies with the exclusive remedies provided in the Act. And so, Mike, if you are taking that position, and I realize you're talking about a statutory claim now, which is a little bit different, but my question to you is, applying that test, which is my understanding of what we need to apply, if there is exclusive jurisdiction, then you wouldn't allow the plaintiff to go to the trial court and pursue common law remedies, because common law remedies would be subsumed by the Act.
I misunderstood your question.
Okay. And I'm trying to understand what your position is on that issue, because what I'm hearing you say with respect to the breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing, what the statute says is an action, a duty sounding in tort. We're dealing with common law there. How, in the face of those provisions, you can take the position that exclusive jurisdiction lies in the board when the statute itself contemplates actions in trial courts on common law, for common law causes of action?
The distinction I'm trying to make is that we're talking about original jurisdiction. We're not talking about exclusive remedies. It is our position the way that the Act should be interpreted is, at least for the original determination of whether it's within the jurisdiction on these particular claims, that it would go to the code.
Then you're saying it's
you're really talking about primary jurisdiction.
I'm talking about primary original jurisdiction, yes.
Okay, now how does that fit in with the statutory scheme? Because I believe it only allows review in the district court by substantial evidence.
Correct.
So under your scenario, the exclusive remedy would be the fines contained in the statute. In other words, what would your case look like when it went to district court?
With regards to how it would look like, it would have gone to the commission first, and there would have been findings. It is our position that the findings with regards to the oral agreement are subsumed by any findings made as to Section 5.02.15.
Would there be any power or vehicle to obtain damages in the district court?
Yes, Your Honor.
How is that under the statutory scheme? If the board can't grant damages and review is limited to substantial evidence, how do you get to a damage claim?
Under Section 6.06, with regards to the DTPA claim, as well as under the duty of good faith and fair dealing, I believe that the statute specifically allows damages in under those claims. With regards to the violation of Section 5.02 and the litany of those violations, I do not believe that the district court will have the ability to award damages in that particular issue.
Why not?
Because of, I'm basing that on the Kawasaki case in 1993, and most recently the interpretation in the sports coach case. And they claim that because of the statute not having the exclusive remedies aspect and not specifically giving the commission, under its interpretation of the statute, the right to award damages, that the commission did not have that authority.
So why doesn't that raise open court about?
I believe that with regards
on the breach of contract and the promissory estoppel claims, why aren't there open courts problems if that's your view?
Well, in this particular case, I believe that there's certain problems with the Court of Appeals actually reaching that decision. First of all,
it wasn't raised.
Yes, it was not raised properly. More importantly, the Texas Attorney General was not served with this complaint, and under Section 37.006 of the Civil Practice and Remedy Code, we believe that's jurisdictional. Second of all, because of the fact that the respondent never actually went to the commission to be told you don't have any remedies, we believe that's no standing. And I think that's the logic that was used by this court in the Texas Workers' Comp versus Garcia case.
Mr. Morris, in your brief, there's a footnote that says that McDavid didn't ask the court to determine the trial court 301 unconstitutional in its declaratory judgment part of its plea.
Yes, Your Honor.
Did they also raise that as a ground in response to your summary judgments that 301 was unconstitutional?
They did at the trial court, yes. They did not plead it, though. And that in they
so it was a response in the motion for summary judgment.
Yes, Your Honor. But the problem is that they did not, they have an affirmative duty under 37.006 to give the Texas Attorney General the opportunity to weigh in on this issue.
Why hasn't the Attorney General done that? We have an amicus brief.
Yes, they did, or at least the one I received was last Friday. Having said that, we believe that Section 37.006 is jurisdictional in that the Court of Appeals should have had the opportunity, and the Texas Attorney General should have had the opportunity at that level to weigh in on the decision and be involved if they so chose to file briefs, argue, you know, respond in kind, etc. And we believe that that is a jurisdictional issue. That's the way that statute has been.
But we have to be mindful of open court's problems. We can't just turn a blind eye to them. How would you answer the open court's question?
With regards to the open court's question, first of all, is our position that that's not right in this particular case. For example, the sports coach case, which just came out a few months ago, I don't know if it's up on appeal. That's where they've actually decided a remedies issue and interpreted Section 6.06 under an exhaustion of remedies analysis. I would respectfully submit that would be more appropriate than at this time.
Well, I understand you don't believe it's right for you, but let's assume that it was. What would your position on it be?
Your Honor, I see how much time may I respond?
Yes.
Okay. The court has held you can't arbitrarily withdraw all remedies and if it's a well-defined common law cause of action in 1876. First of all, with regards to the good faith and fair dealing, that was not a common law cause of action. So that does not apply. Second of all, with regards to promissory estoppel, we would submit that the Supreme Court did not adopt a cause of action for promissory estoppel until the case of Wheeler versus White, which was in 1966. So at that point, that's also outside that analysis. And thirdly, the second issue is with regard to the oral breach of contract. A court should consider both the purpose of the statute, which in this case is that the commission is supposed to regulate motor vehicle distribution and sales. And second of all, the extent of the harm done if the common law action is not allowed. In this particular case, under these particular facts, Mr. McDavid would not have been harmed in any event. With regards to the breach of contract, we are dealing with also the claim of good faith and fair dealing. All right. If the commission had held that we had breached the contract, it would also probably have held that there was a breach of the good faith and fair dealing. Second of all, the breach of the contract also would allow the DTPA claims and damages and remedies. So thus, even though with regards to the oral agreement, we submit that under Section 5.02.12 that should go within that area, Mr. McDavid would have gotten the same actual damages, the same attorney's fees, and a punitive aspect if, in fact, they could prove this case in the district court.
Mr. Morris, to go with your position, you're essentially arguing that the court should give a broad reading to the statutory provisions that govern the conduct of the board.
I'm not necessarily saying that, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that under these facts, commission should have had the original jurisdiction, at least in part, to determine whether it's been a violation of the code. If the commission had decided that it was not a violation of the code or it didn't.
But your argument is to get to that, we have to acknowledge that there are certain, that in the absence of denying the board's authority to make rulings in certain areas, there's an implication that they could.
We're saying that there should be, that with regards to an absence of an express, that the underlying factual underpinnings, that in order to facilitate the commission's duties, it is necessary that they weigh in.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counselor. And of course, ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Stephen Khoury will present argument for the respondents.
Please, the court. Good morning. Let me begin by saying it's nice to see all of you all here this morning. Some of you, it's been a very long time, and for me, that's been many hair follicles ago. I'd like to first start out this morning by addressing what appears to be a metamorphosis in the arguments made by Subaru throughout the trial of this lawsuit. In the summary judgment motion, their position was the jurisdiction of the TMVB was jurisdictional and that it was exclusive, and that as a result of that, following Navistar, the Texarkana case, and the dicta in Texarkana that all common law causes of actions are preempted. His argument to the court was we had no lawsuit for damages by way of contract, promissory estoppel, or any other cause of action. He held that view up in the arguments in front of the Dallas Court of Appeals. They rejected it. And I think on the strength of the TADA brief, amicus brief filed here, and the strength of the Attorney General's brief filed here, that argument now has changed or modified itself to be one of primary jurisdiction, or now what is somehow ambiguously labeled as original primary exclusive jurisdiction, and those concepts I think have all been blended without any clear delineation. Taking their argument,
your view is then that we're really talking about a primary jurisdiction issue and we need to apply that test, is that correct?
I think so, Your Honor. And with respect to the argument that in its pristine form as they made it here, they would have this court believe that if you read 301 literally, and that is that all aspects of any dealings between car dealers or in the automobile business could be subjected to exclusive jurisdiction of the board. And that means that the most trivial or most mundane cause of action for debt, insofar as a failure on the part of a dealer to pay the inventory or floor plan to the manufacturer, for enforcement of indemnities between the two, or for that matter, if you read it broad enough, as they did, with no limitation, it would encompass common law actions between a consumer and a car dealer for any breach in the sales transaction or failure in the service contract. To take this theory, then each and every common law action, many of which have already been litigated, and to that extent, if there was no jurisdiction between manufacturer and dealers in the legions of cases filed over the last...
Well, then what is the scope of 301B? Is it the way you're talking about it makes it seem virtually meaningless?
Judge, I'm not sure I know what the legislature meant when it said unless specifically delegated or set out by Texas law to the contrary.
The way you're talking makes it seem as though in reality, as you would apply it, no dispute concerning the distribution or sale of motor vehicles must be brought through this act. It can be brought separately in the state district court.
I think what the legislature was trying to do in the TADA wanted at the time with respect to their efforts to protect franchise dealers against franchisors was to give the board that power, exclusive power, to deal in areas that were contained in the act, as opposed to trying to regulate and give them power to regulate common law cause of action. I think that the only interpretation you can glean from this, if you take the position that 301B says unless Texas law specifically sets out to the contrary, which must include common law cause of action, if that's what they mean by specifically, and if other statutory claims or other things set out in the statute are not in conflict with this act, then the only thing that the board does have jurisdiction to handle are those specific delineated provisions within the TMVB code.
Under 502?
Under 502 is one of them. The Lemon Law is under the Texas Motor Vehicle Act. There are other provisions that we use every day in the practice of law for redress.
Let me ask you this. Under 502A.
Yes.
I'm sorry, 502-2A. I'm sorry, 502-3A. Talks about terminating or refusing to terminate any franchise with a dealer, or directly or indirectly force or attempt to force a dealer to relocate.
I think as a matter of practice and as a matter of law, that has always been the exclusive jurisdiction and purview of the board. They have specialized knowledge and have for 30 years dealt with the challenge or the wrongfulness in a termination. I think that also applies to relocation of dealerships. I don't think there's any question about when a request is made and the dealer objects, that the board has the initial exclusive jurisdiction to deal with that issue.
But how is this really any different?
What's the difference in effect
between oral and written?
The biggest difference here, Judge, is this was not a case where we are testing the reasonableness of the request to relocate. The facts in this case are that we had a deal to relocate. We never had a written request before the board that they challenged, that the issue now becomes the reasonableness of the move. That's what the board has jurisdiction to, whether it's written or oral. That's what their jurisdiction is, in my opinion. The facts in this case show that Mr. Gage and Mr. McDavid made a deal, albeit a handshake agreement, that Mr. McDavid moved on because that's his nature to, maybe not so much anymore, but to deal in relationships and orally with people. He made a deal as a result of that affirmative agreement to permit him to move. He not only spent $350,000, he moved the Oldsmobile dealership from 6800 Gulf Freeway to the 11200 Gulf Freeway, and was in position now to have to move Subaru to the 6800 address because Oldsmobile was now dual to Nissan. There wasn't any room to operate another dealership. So at that point in time, he gets a letter from Mr. Gage and says, I don't know what you think you're doing or what agreement you think I made, but you don't have a right to move your dealership. So now he's stuck with a franchise that he can't operate in that location, and now he's told he can't move. And we know the TMVB process is anywhere from 12 to 18 months, so he can't hold his assets there and his personnel there and not operate for 18 months while his reliance damages continue to mount and hemorrhage, so he terminates his dealership. And then 4 months after the termination, Gage and Subaru permit a Subaru dealer to be installed at 6700 Gulf Freeway, which is a matter of inches from our location at 6800. So we say the facts in this case are that we had a deal and they breached it, and we were seeking reliance damages, and that the board can't pass on reasonableness because there wasn't an issue as to whether or not it was reasonable to move.
The DTPA claim and the bad faith claims are based on the same allegations.
Yes, sir.
Why don't you have to go to the board first on those?
Well, the Court of Appeals decided that we had to go to the board on the DTPA. They did not decide that way for the tort of good faith and fair deal.
So do you agree with the Court of Appeals that the board has primary jurisdiction over the DTPA claim? And you've got to go there first on that claim?
If the language in the statute means what the Court of Appeals in Dallas thought it meant.
Do you agree with that, or do you have a different interpretation?
I have a question, Judge, in that I'm not sure I know what the language in 606 means when it says we are to pay due deference to findings of the court. Does that mean that...
Findings of the board.
Finding of the board. Does that mean that as far as now the statutory action, the DTPA, we must first go to the board and get findings as to the liability, and then subsequent to that, flip it into the district court for now a trial on the damage issue that a jury decides?
Well, what else could it mean? Doesn't it require some action on the part of the board? I mean, you agree with that at least.
I think implicit in its language, it calls for some action by the board. I'm just not in my experience.
Okay, so is it your position then that you do have to go to the take the DTPA claim to the board first for something, even though you're not sure what?
If the statute means that findings should be made first by the board with respect to liability. I do not believe in the scheme of any administrative act that I'm aware of that we have this hybrid where the board is permitted to find the issues of liability initially and then flip it to the district court after that finding that now they pay due deference to with respect to liability and have a trial on the damages.
What is it you're asking us to do with the DTPA claim? I mean, I keep hearing you're not quite sure, but
I'll tell you that we didn't appeal it to this court, so we're basically hung with it.
Okay. All right.
I think our main issue in this case, and it's always been, a breach of contract claim and promissory estoppel.
Okay. And is it your position that on the breach of contract and promissory estoppel claims that the board has no primary jurisdiction over them?
And has no jurisdiction over.
Okay.
And need not be permitted and shouldn't be permitted to pass on the question as to whether or not they could be brought in a common law court because it doesn't have the power expressly given it to in the statute or by implication.
Now, aren't you still alleging, though, a violation of the statute as well, 502B15?
And I think that has been decided by the Court of Appeals, too, that we did not appeal to this court.
Okay, so what you're asking us to decide in this case now are the breach of contract and promissory estoppel claims.
I think that's the...
And that's all that's left. You're going to sit with what the Court of Appeals did on the other claims.
I don't know that...
But as long as you have to go to the board on the DTPA claim and the bad faith claim, why shouldn't the breach of contract and promissory estoppel claims, which are based on the same allegations, abate until findings are made by the board?
Well, they may have to abate. I think dismissal would be the wrong and most egregious penalty.
But you agree that if they're based on the same allegation, you can't really divide them up and let both the board and the court go forward?
No, I think you can divide them up. And I say that it would be impermissible and be impractical in our scheme to require a litigant to take those just because they arise out of the same facts. The board obviously has its jurisdiction that it can handle. The fact that another cause of action arises out of the same facts doesn't give the board any more power to address those issues, the common law issues. So I would say the fact that they have commonality of facts it should not be a determining factor insofar as whether you go to the board.
But doesn't the law require that when concurrent jurisdiction exists in the trial court on certain claims, and in an administrative agency on other claims, that the agency should proceed first before the court does?
Except to the extent that the other causes of action being sought are outside the ability of the tribunal to...
Well, but no, I understand that. That's my question. That's my question. Yeah. You've got some claims that you're saying that the board does not have jurisdiction over, does not have primary jurisdiction over. They're outside the board's power to hear, and they belong in the courts. And you've got other claims that, by virtue of not challenging at least what the Court of Appeals did, we now know by the Court of Appeals' opinion as to this case that the board has primary jurisdiction over them. So we've got claims where we've got the board having jurisdiction over some of them and claims where the court does.
Right.
And if that's the case, then we've got concurrent jurisdiction over a set of claims arising out of the same set of facts. My question to you is, under Texas law, aren't we then required to allow the agency to proceed first before the trial court?
I don't think there's anything in Texas law that prevents the litigant from filing in district court for the common law claim.
That's not a question.
Sir?
Her question is, once you've filed it, can you go ahead in the district court while the board is deciding the factual issues in the ones that they have?
I think the appropriate procedure is to abate.
Which is what Forey would...
Yes, sir.
And not dismissed. That's your point.
Right. And I think the reason we must be permitted to file our action in district court and not the board is to preserve statute of limitations problem.
Would you agree, though, that the district court proceeding would be abated under your theory of how the statute would be interpreted?
I do not object to that. I object to dismissal in the district court.
You said you're seeking just reliance damages. Could you be more specific about exactly what you are seeking damage-wise?
Insofar as the agreement that was made permitted us to move, and Mr. McDavid's company spent $350,000 in relocation expenses in reconstituting the dealership where the Oldsmobile dealership was going to, in order to satisfy Oldsmobile's manufacturer's requirement with respect to that, and made the same sort of accommodations to the 6800 address where Subaru was going. So our action was to recover the damages that we spent and that we lost with respect to terminating this Subaru dealership that we could not move now and had no ability to...
So your damages aren't simply limited to relocation damages. You're also suing for wrongful termination or as a consequence?
For the consequential damages that arose from the failure now to operate up until the time that we terminated the dealership.
But your position would be that if you abandon your DTPA and bad faith claims, then you could just go forward on your contract claim and your promissory estoppel claim. There would be no impediment to that.
You're outside the code, in our opinion.
But you're not suggesting that you're abandoning those claims, are you? You're just saying that you didn't appeal those here and you're content with them going back to the board. Is that correct?
Correct.
And only if you abandoned them would you be able to proceed under what we just talked about in the district court.
Yes. Okay.
Well, under that scheme, does the statute violate open courts?
Well, then I think you have a case-by-case determination as to what the statute means. I think that the Court of Appeals in Dallas concluded what you can only conclude if you read the very expansive language in 301, and that is it eats up everything. And to that extent, it is clearly violative of the open courts provision. And with respect to the no notice to the Attorney General, I have a clear disagreement with respect to what 37006 says in terms of having to give the Attorney General notice. And I think the cases back that up in that notice is not required in an action that declaratory judgment is not alleged or a municipal ordinance or franchise. Municipal franchise is not alleged. And in the event constitutionality is raised with respect as a result of a motion being filed or in the case of the Scurlock case that they filed as support of their position when the court sua sponte decided that the statute was unconstitutional, in those situations, notice to the Attorney General are not required. But I think Justice O'Neill pointed out what is the practical result is they're here, and I'm not sure any of those arguments, I don't think they're jurisdictional. There are arguments now that somehow that the state of Texas and the citizens thereof have been prejudiced because the Attorney General was not notified is moot because they are here and they are before us and they weighed in on this issue, and their brief is not inconsistent with our position that the board does not have exclusive jurisdiction on common law.
Let's assume for a minute that you'd had a written contract, and initially Subaru had said, yes, you can go ahead and move. We're not going to object. But then within the 90-day period, or I forget what the period is in the statute, they then submitted in writing and said, no, we've changed our mind. We don't want you to move. Would you have to go to the board under those circumstances?
I don't think so.
Why not?
I don't think the rationale is any different, whether it's written or oral.
If you're going to sue not just for reliance damages in the beginning to relocate, and you're going to sue for the inability to move and go beyond that and also sue the inability to move, why isn't that within the board's jurisdiction, at least initially, on whether Subaru was reasonable in saying, no, we don't want you to move?
Because I think 50215 gives them the jurisdiction to determine whether or not a requested relocation is reasonable or not.
And what if Subaru had taken it to the board and they said, and the board would say, yes, Subaru was reasonable in denying you permission to move, even though they initially said, okay, when they changed their mind, they were reasonable in denying it. Wouldn't you have to go to the board
Then I think they've overstepped their jurisdictional bounds
and find
whether or not there was an agreement between the parties and whether or not there was an actionable breach. Because once an agreement's made, 50215 is irrelevant. 50215 just deals with a dealer's request to move in writing that a manufacturer resists.
So you're saying once the dealer either orally or otherwise consents, they can't change their mind.
In the words of the great Professor Horner, a deal is a deal is a deal, is our opinion.
So your argument, if I understand your argument, there, dealers and manufacturers in this state can contract to do something that the board might otherwise not let them do if somebody challenges it based on reasonableness. But if they have contracted, there's still a binding obligation against one party to the other for damages, even if the board later determines that they could not have entered into that contract.
I think so. Now the issue becomes, in our case, as to whether or not Mr. McDavid's franchise would have been licensed to move. We all know that dealers make arrangements, business arrangements, with other dealers who might ultimately protest the relocation well before they've ever decided to go to the manufacturer, because you don't want to spend that kind of money without that. But in this case, I think factually it's moot, because 4 months after we terminated, they put a Subaru dealership in a block away or next door to where we were. So the issue with respect to that is an element of proof that will be before the district court, is not something before this court. But obviously, I think from a factual standpoint, it's moot.
Well, is there some logic to the notion that if you have a regulated industry, which this is to a certain extent, that any contracts among the players by implication will incorporate the regulations? In other words, because the location of a dealership is subject to regulation by the board, isn't it isn't it reasonable to say that a contract between the dealer and the manufacturer about locating a dealership by implication is subject to those regulations?
I think with respect to the issue as to reasonableness on relocation, it falls within that purview, but as to whether or not they can move based on whether or not they will be a licensed dealer, I think is outside the code. I know that the TMBC code regulates the contracts between manufacturers and franchisees and say this is going to be in your contract whether you like it or not, and anything to the contrary notwithstanding. But I guess you're saying that if there is an agreement that somehow conflicts with the power of the board and the power and the board ultimately finds otherwise?
I guess the dealership can't be located there unless the board says so. I mean, it could be, but if somebody challenges it, then the board makes the decision whether or not a dealership could be located there, doesn't it?
Yes, sir.
And I think that's by law. So isn't it reasonable to say that any contract for the relocation of a dealership between private parties by implication must incorporate the regulation of the state that if there's an objection, there won't be a relocation?
Yes, sir. It is implicitly incorporated, but it's the second step to the process. And I would point out that a simple objection does not mean that the board is going to deny your right to move. And all I'm saying is that is, I think, an element of our proof in our damage model that we would have been permitted to relocate and the board would not have otherwise stopped that, without which we could not probably have recovered any reliance damage.
So why shouldn't the board answer that question now before you go forward?
Well,
rather than just litigate about what they might have done.
If the issue of abatement occurs, the reasonableness or protest with respect to the relocation may be an area that they look into. I don't know that the board would go into it's like this court would not render an opinion on a hypothetical set of facts. I don't know that they would hold a hearing and say, if the agreement in district court is found to have been binding on Subaru to permit McDavid, everybody in the state tell us what your objections would be and file them so we can make a determination as to. I don't think they'd go through that empty exercise to determine whether relocation should be licensed when there's not one going before and there's not a request and you're suing on the damages. So it would kind of be a waste of the board's time, and I doubt they'd take that position. I doubt that they would spend the time that they have to give you an advisory opinion as to whether or not they would or would not have permitted it to be relocated.
So this is what's troublesome. Let's suppose that you ask your sewer to relocate, and they say no. You say, well, I don't have the money, and I can't wait the 18 months to get a board decision, so I'm just going to terminate my dealership and then now sue Subaru for failure to allow me to move. And you're saying that since there's no move, the board doesn't get to resolve that issue. I mean, aren't we really making an end run then around what the statute is?
I don't think so, Justice Owen, because in your situation there was not an agreement. There was a request and a denial. So then you're required to go to the board.
But you're suing for denial when it's never been before the board, then you're arguing in front of a judge or jury what the board would or would not have done.
I say we're suing for a breach of an agreement to move. It wasn't.
No, I'm saying I've got a different example.
Okay.
My example is you ask for permission, you're denied permission, you say I can't keep my dealership here for the next 18 months. I'm just going to terminate the dealership.
You're denied by permission by whom?
By Subaru. Subaru says you can't move, so you terminate your dealership, and then you sue Subaru for the failure to grant permission to move without going to the board. And you're saying the board would not look at those facts because it's an ongoing.
No, I think in that situation, the plaintiff gets thrown out for not going to the board and contesting the denial as being unreasonable. I think the dealer has to go to the board when you ask the dealer, the manufacturer, to move, and they say no.
Why shouldn't you have to go to the board on that one piece of your damage model, the way you put it, on would the board, was Subaru unreasonable in ultimately denying you the right to move? It's one thing to sue for reliance damages in an oral contract. Why wouldn't you have to get a board determination on the reasonableness of their ultimate refusal to allow you to move?
Reasonableness or licensure?
Reasonableness.
Of the location.
reasonableness of them saying, you can't move, we're not going to let you move?
Because we had a deal where the manufacturer agreed we could move. Going to the court with respect to the unreasonableness of the denial is not the question.
Well, then they changed their mind and said, no, we're not going to let you move.
Who changes their mind?
Subaru.
Well, I think once they say they're well, that's what happened here.
That's my point. Why wouldn't you have to go to the board on that second to get the second piece of your damages?
Because
on the denial of
at that time they've got tar all over them that they can't just simply wipe off by their denial. We've got reliance, we've got promissory estoppel, we have a breach of contract. I know they would like to now say no. We said yes,
but the board could say Subaru is well within its rights for not allowing you to move. That doesn't mean that you can't sue for the reliance damages that you suffered up until the time they said no.
I would just respectfully say that I don't think the board has the power to say that we can't after a deal was struck where both parties agreed we could. I don't think they can come back. I don't think they have the power expressly or implicitly to undo our agreement after it's already made. And Subaru should respond to damages on the breach. If you didn't have that, then there wouldn't be any recourse for a manufacturer to say yes and then let you do what you want to do and decide later to say no, because they know that that issue has to be determined by the board and they have a good chance of beating you there. I think you deprive the citizens of the common law rights to sue for the damages or the reliance.
You can sue for your reliance damages, all the costs that you incurred in getting ready to relocate, but isn't it a different issue when you now sue for failure to grant permission to move?
I see the distinction you're drawing, but I can't seem to get over the issue of the deal having been done, and there's nothing that's within the purview of the court as to the reasonableness of the move, because we've already got the deal.
So you're saying that if this were a failure to grant permission to move, it could be within the board's purview?
I think it is.
But that's not what happened here.
That's right.
You had a deal, and then
you say that I don't think the board has the power to say that we can't after a deal was struck where both parties agreed we could. I don't think they can come back. I don't think they have the power expressly or implicitly to undo our agreement after it's already made. And Subaru should respond to damages on the breach. If you didn't have that, then there wouldn't be any recourse for a manufacturer to say yes and then let you do what you want to do and decide later to say no, because they know that that issue has to be determined by the board and they have a good chance of beating you there. I think you deprive the citizens of the common law rights to sue for the damages or the reliance.
You can sue for your reliance damages, all the costs that you incurred in getting ready to relocate, but isn't it a different issue when you now sue for failure to grant permission to move?
I see the distinction you're drawing, but I can't seem to get over the issue of the deal having been done, and there's nothing that's within the purview of the court as to the reasonableness of the move, because we've already got the deal.
So you're saying that if this were a failure to grant permission to move, it could be within the board's purview?
I think it is.
But that's not what happened here.
That's right.
You had a deal, and then they called off the deal.
Absolutely.
And you're suing because they called off the deal. And that's totally different than a rejection of a relocation request.
I think the Court of Appeals seized on that as the distinction.
If the deal is done, can a third party protest it before the board?
Well, they can with respect to the licensure of the move.
And what would be the effect of that? Let's say that you had an agreement and a third party challenged it before the board. What could the board do? Could the board then say there is no deal? And if so, what would the damage, or would there still be a cause of action then because of breach of the
I think agreement? The damages, I think you'd have a cause of action. I think the damages would be zero. I think if you had a deal to move and the manufacturer went along with it all the way through the board process and you went and spent $350,000 to do the move and you got to the protest portion of the two-step process. First, you got the agreement. Second, you put it out in public notice that McDavid's going to put a Subaru dealership in this location. Everybody who's within 15 miles or has a protest filed. And once that's done, if the protest comes back and the board finds that we're not going to let McDavid move over there, then I think we have no cause of action against Subaru because we've got no damage. We're not going to come back and sue them.
Is there anything that would prevent a third party here in the status of this case as it sits now from filing a protest with the board, or is the time run on that?
I think, well, I don't know that there's a time issue, but I think the issue is moot because we're not putting the dealership there and chose not to because we didn't have anywhere to go. I think the most telling bit of evidence in this case is that 3 months after we terminated, they did put a Subaru dealership there. And I think that sends very clear signals as to what the status of the protest was in that area, and that there was none.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Mr. Bruce Morris will present the rebuttal for the petitioners.
May it please the Court. Your Honor, there's several issues I'd like to address. First of all, we are not saying that all issues regarding a manufacturer-dealer situation goes to the board. That's not what we're saying at all. What we're saying, because of the special nature of relocation issues, under this particular fact pattern, these claims that respondent made should have gone to the board.
But is the specifics of this fact pattern that your opposition contends takes it outside of the board purview, which is that it wasn't a relocation request that was denied. It was a deal struck that was later rescinded. And why would that latter category fall within the board purview?
If I may, Your Honor, the way a relocation procedure works, there's several hoops someone must go through, okay? A dealer cannot unilaterally agree with the manufacturer to relocate.
They're saying it was not unilateral.
Oh, okay, mutual. Even if there's an agreement, they cannot make that decision. Reading specifically from the Friendly case that was cited in our brief, the board has said, the Motor Vehicle Board has virtually absolute power to deny the applicant the right to move, and the prudent businessman will seek the state's permission to relocate.
Well, they're saying that didn't happen. They said that everyone agreed.
That presents an applicant.
Your Honor, under the facts, in the record, as compared to some of the facts that are not in the record, Mr. McDavid, under Section 402 of the Code, before a relocation can take place, the dealer must have a written application granted, not applied for, granted, before they can relocate. And the reason being is under the statutory scheme, relocation does not just affect the manufacturer and the dealer. It also affects third-party dealers that may have a protest right, as well as consumers that may have a protest right.
But doesn't that all go to defenses that you might have in connection with a breach of contract action to recover damages? For example, well, we may have had a deal, but you didn't do what you're supposed to do, and you wouldn't have gotten the board's permission, so it wasn't us that caused damage. I mean, fit it in the context of these common law claims.
That would be our argument, Your Honor.
Well, then why isn't that a defense to a common law cause of action that belongs in the district court?
Because we believe the issue goes to the original jurisdiction, the primary
jurisdiction.
Okay,
you keep talking about original jurisdiction, and I know that that word is in there, but we've been talking with you about exclusive jurisdiction and primary jurisdiction since that seems to be the issue we have to decide.
Sure.
Now, if I understood the response to your questions earlier, you're not really contending, I think, that there's exclusive jurisdiction. That the legislature intended the remedies in the Act to be exclusive and to wipe out common law remedies. Is that right?
I agree. I believe that there's exclusive original jurisdiction. I do not believe there's exclusive
Is exclusive? Well, I don't understand what you mean by exclusive original jurisdiction.
By that I mean that all that was required is that you go to the commission first, get factual findings on the issues before the commission, and then it goes back up.
All right, well, why isn't that a matter of primary jurisdiction as opposed to exclusive jurisdiction, concurrent primary jurisdiction, that there are certain matters that have to go to the board first, but that the board is not going to hear the common law causes of action, and the trial court just must wait until the board gets done?
It can be.
All right, so you agree that this is a case of primary jurisdiction, then?
Alternatively, yes, Your Honor.
What are you going to ask the board to decide? What specific things should the board decide? Whether we would have agreed with the relocation? Approved it?
First of all, under the fact pattern, the respondent would have had to file a written application.
What do you want? I just want you to tell me what you want the board to decide. What issue do they need to decide so that the district court case can go forward?
They would need to decide whether if there was such a denial, and there was, whether that denial was reasonable. Then the second step would be, if they found that denial was unreasonable, then they would then need to wait and send out a notice of protest letter, which is required under the statute under Section 4.06, and then see if there's any third party.
But you can't do that now because there's not even an issue anymore about the relocation. It's gone.
Yes, Your Honor.
How can the board decide that?
Well, it seems to me that it's actually a cart before the horse problem. Because the respondent chose not to go to the TMVC, and the respondent, we submit, clearly know the regulations and the rules under the TMVC. In fact, there's at least one reported case in which they were the dealership that tried to protest a relocation. That it was their decision not to go to the TMVCs, not the manufacturers. And, you know, they're just stuck with what they did. With regards to the dismissal versus an abatement, that's clearly been historically within the discretion of a court whether to dismiss or abate.
Well, let me before you get to that point, it seems there's a fundamental disagreement between you two as to whether the manufacturer and the dealer can enter an agreement outside the board. I mean, if the parties can enter into an agreement on their own without going before the board, presume that to be the case. Would you agree with your opponent's position then? That seems like a fundamental point of disagreement.
I see my time to answer. Yeah. With regards to that, it depends on what the contract is. With regards to the facts under this case, i.e., I will agree to you to relocate our dealership from a high crime area to a nice NASA area, and then
But are you saying that parties cannot enter into relocation agreements without going to the board in the first instance?
You mean to enforce a breach of that agreement?
No. Could this agreement have gone forward without it going to the board?
No, Your Honor. And the reason I say that is under Section 1.04, of the Act specifically says any agreements in violation of the Act are void or unenforceable.
Well, why does it say that the parties have to go before the board to approve any agreements to relocate?
That's not in the statute.
But you're reading that in.
No.
Okay. Or can they not agree between themselves to the relocation without going to the board?
The answer is they can agree, and in most instances they do. The legal effect of that agreement is irrelevant until the board officially agrees, accepts the relocation.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Case is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
All rise.